Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz. This is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On today's show, we have speaker, writer, changemaker, elder, Mac McCartney. And we also catch up with Dr. Ruth Allen, who tells us about how her trip across Bosnia went from having spoken to her a couple of months ago. But first, to set the tone for Mac's interview, we're going to have Apache Sunrise by the Native American Indian. The Apache Sunrise song, quite stirring, isn't it? Okay, so how to describe Mac McCartney is a big task. I would describe him as an elder. He was mentored for many years by Native Americans and has gone on to take those teachings sort of out into the world. I think a question that he poses, which kind of sums up his ethos and his mentality in his work, is what if we put nature and people before profit? How would the world look then? It's a good question, and it spins the way we've constructed society on its head, really. A lot of this show is given over to the interview with Mac because I really value and appreciate what he has to say, so hopefully you will too. He was in town for an event to launch his new book, The Children's Fire, Heart Song of a People. The first section here is him explaining how he came to discover what the children's fire is, and a little bit about what the book then contains. So here's Mac.
A long time ago in the early 80s, when I had finally accessed this group of Native Americans with the request that they teach me and fill in the education, I was going to say complete my education. It wasn't really about completing it. It was teach me the things that I'd always wanted to learn and never been taught. And that was quite a long and arduous assessment process as they tried to work out whether I was worth the investment of their time, because they weren't thinking in terms of a quick visit or something. This was would go on for years. In the event, it went on for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not
continuously.
Yeah.
No.
That's a long time. Yeah.
That first visit, I was there for 3 months and then went away again. And then, you know, it would be visiting them or them visiting me once or twice a year, that sort of thing. Staying for a few months or something.
Where was that?
They had land in the coastal mountains of Northern California where they had all come together, purchased land, and were living and earning their living as artists. And all of them were medicine people who were going back into and developing all the ceremonies and things. So there are two things that happened on that first visit that are significant for the book. One was that on one particular snowy, cold, early year meeting, I was informed that I was to attend a meeting in a glade in the forest, up the forest track, and I made my way there a little bit nervous because many of the encounters I had with them were very challenging. And on this occasion, they had a circle of them sitting there, and there was a place for me. And I sat down, and they said, tonight we wish to introduce you to a small fragment of the wisdom teachings that informed our people for many, many years, called the Children's Fire. And then they spoke about the challenge that they had known about for a long time and that exists for all human communities, the fact that when we elect or select or have selected for us leaders who in some way govern, lead, influence our lives, as it were, in our context, whether that would be religious leaders, government, you know, MPs, whether it would be university professors or whatever it is. There's nearly always some group of people that have some influence on our lives. They had noticed that whilst many of those people begin with good intentions to serve a higher cause, that it doesn't often take too long before those leaders begin to make decisions and choices which serve their own best interests or their own community of leaders and not the people whom they are there to serve. Seems like this is not just something unique to Britain, Europe or the States, but...
Humans.
They said they pondered this question a long time, and one of the things that emerged was this idea that every time when they sat in council, the council of chiefs, women and men, took their seats, they would kindle a little fire in the centre of this circle called the children's fire. And each of the chiefs would be required to make a pledge to the children's fire. And the pledge went something like, no law, no decision, no action, nothing of any kind will be permitted to go out from this circle of chiefs that will harm the children. The whole notion that the children is actually does not refer exclusively to human children, but to the young of all kind. So that would be young trees, young birds, young all, everything. Because the very simple understanding that, you know, these are our investment. This is, you know, we all species live somehow, at least in part, to and dream of the continuation of the line that has brought them to here. So the children carry our dreams forward. The children are what we give them our legacy, as it were, and they walk it forward. So in some ways you could say it's a pledge to life, really. I mean, it's just a very wonderful, affirming pledge which makes it very clear and obvious that the while all of us have our own ambitions and goals and needs and everything, that when decisions are made which are going to affect the lives of people and the lives of others, that they should be considered on the basis of how it might affect longer term. So that was that little piece. Now the other piece was, as part of this assessment process, they wanted to understand what I already knew or didn't know. So I'll be speaking about this evening, but they were saying, you know, you're educated. And I said, well, yeah. you've studied history. I've attended history lessons.
Bit different.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we're sure that you won't have simply just accepted what you were spoon-fed, but will have inquired a little deeper. So we have a question to ask you. You know. Name your tribes. And I was confused by the question, you know, and yeah. Really didn't quite know what they meant. And name my tribes. I don't think we have any tribes, and they were looking at me like I was completely stupid. Well, I was being completely stupid, but they said, you know, Mac, you know, anybody would know, surely, that prior to whatever your history, wherever you consider your history to have begun, before, you would have been an indigenous people and a tribal people. And you know, you had tribes. So you know, they were getting a little fretful at this point. They were saying, surely you know at least one of the names of your ancient tribes, and I didn't. And then one of them just stood up, and now the atmosphere had gone quite chilly, and he just said, Coritani, Ordovici, Trinovantes, Atrebates, Brigantes, Dumnonii, Cornovii. They went on and on 20.
Wow.
How come we know the names of 20 of your British tribes, and you don't even know one? And I was actually close to weeping. I was feeling very... Because there was something about these names and the feeling that we were a tribal people that was so exciting, thrilling to me. And then he said, how come? He said, because we are curious and ask questions.
Mm.
And that was it.
That was it. God, a way to feel deflated.
So I did. Yeah. And I felt dreadful. And,
yeah.
And anyway, they basically said, you know, you are a Brit. You've always been a Brit. You always will be a Brit. You're not Native American. The beautiful thing that we can offer you is to help you unlock the gateway to your own indigenous past and help you find the threads of your ancient stories, songs, and ceremonies. And that was just so, you know, that helped me recover, really, because I just thought, wow, that feels so good. So what the book does is take the history, what happened to Britain 2,000 years ago in that period of time during the Roman occupation. And it tells the story a little bit of what happened to us when Rome arrived. We, at that time, these islands were like the equivalent of Tibet today.
So people came to
our islands to learn. These were the holy islands. These were the islands that pulse with magic, vibrant with ancient mystery. These, you know, and it's not to say that other places were not also, but at this period of history, this is where it was. The drum was being sounded, and people from all different tribes and nations in what we would now call Europe were traveling to this immense adventure and then having to cross the sea and then having to get across England and up through what we now call Wales and finally stand on the shores of the Menai Straits and make that small journey across to the island where they would begin what apparently, according to the Irish records, was a 20-year training.
Incredible stuff. I mean, I certainly didn't know about the tribal history of this country, of these islands, and I think it's testament to the fact that the victor rights history, as we know, the Romans invaded, they won, and then essentially they write the history. So the indigenous people of these isles kind of, you know, they get dismissed as silly and kind of comical figures, as if they said, yeah, cool, hi Romans, come in, great, nice one, let's invent trade and sewers. We carried on that discussion and, you know, we talked a bit about some of the stories, some of the savage stories about what the Romans did and the massacre that took place. It was vast, enormous, brutal. You know, a million were killed, another million were enslaved. Any uprising from the indigenous people, you know, the retribution from the Romans was a thousandfold in retaliation. I found it fascinating that it was Anglesey or Mona, as it used to be known, that was this sort of spiritual epicentre and where the Romans really had to fight the hardest as well to conquer that part of Britain. So with that in mind, with this knowledge that Mona is this golden island, really, Mac undertook an earth walk or a pilgrimage from where he was born in the Malvern Hills over to Anglesey. So this next little bit is Mac describing a little bit more about that experience and some of the reasons that he undertook it.
So the trauma, the history, the children's fire, and I, as one part of all of this, many years later, in 2009, hit on the idea that I would undertake a ceremony myself of walking from where I was born in the Malvern across skirting Siluri's territory, going through Ordovici territory, and ultimately coming to Mona, carrying an Iceni chariot ring dated to AD 60 when Boudicca fought her last battle.
Wow.
And announced to the island that we are not defeated, that we are standing again. and that there are many, many people who are in their different ways seeking to rekindle the children's fire.
Ooh. Ooh. I wanted to talk to you about that that walk, pilgrimage.
Mm.
And you did it in January.
Mm.
And you ate only foods that came from the land.
Yes, yes.
How was that experience? What did that... Well, you were completely alone and you walked how many miles?
I don't know how many miles. I've never worked it out. But
okay.
I mean, I started on the... Well, it's called the British Camp. It's an Iron Age hill fort in the Malvern Hills. And I didn't have a map or compass, so I was navigating by the stars and the sun, and I had no idea what I was walking into: roads, lanes, fields, rivers, mountains. I say I had no idea. Of course, I've lived a life, so I knew that somewhere over there is Hereford, and I knew that when I made it to Snowdonia, because I used to live in North Wales, I would know. But that's wonderful, but when you're standing there, yeah, you know, in the pitch black, you know, which way do I go? It's different.
Yeah.
So the traveling without a map or compass, traveling without a stove, so that I had all my anything I, if I wanted it warm, drank or ate, I had to make a fire. To make a fire in that way, obviously I need dry kindling.
Mm.
So I carried always a little bundle of kindling stuffed down the front of my trousers where it would be warm and dry. But I realised how precious it was. If I use that to light a fire, I now have no kindling. Mm. So I have to find more kindling ready for the next fire. I can't leave that too late because it's hard to find it when it's pitch black. And it needs to be of the right kind of kindling. So, yeah. I had never imagined that I would have difficulty with water crossing Wales, of all places,
yeah.
But it was mostly frozen. That winter, it went down to minus 15 in mid-Wales.
Goodness me.
That January.
Wow.
When I walked.
And you were sleeping outside.
Yes, I also decided I didn't want a tent. Because tents are a general, yeah. Tents are rather miserable places at the best
they are
of times,
horrible.
Yeah. But so I wanted to be outside. I had a bivy bag, but to be outside, a little fire, you know, and cook my food, and what was it? I mean, and winter time, January, because it is the dreaming time, and this was a dreaming ceremony, and I needed to go during the period of the most darkness. And it was also a journey into the trauma of that time 2,000 years ago, a journey into the memory of people that have now nothing but shadows and sort of flutterings and whisperings, ghost-like in the landscape. A journey, an external but an internal journey into those parts of me that could feel their way to that time. So it was January, so yes, it was dark from, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning to 4:30, really. Mm. It was freezing cold, and I was mostly thirsty and hungry the whole way.
Mm.
And it was utterly beautiful. It was the most exquisite experience. And it had many challenges. I was also 60 when I did that. So
wow.
My next birthday, I'm 70, so it was sort of, I had forgotten that somehow, the shock of realizing, gosh, you know, I'm not really as strong or capable as I used to be. You know, is this okay?
Mm.
And I wonder how cold it is. It seems to be getting absolutely freezing, you know. So, because I had no access to the new weather. And people, I would encounter people and they'd say, you know, how are you? You're not camping, are you? And I said, well, I'm bivvying. It must be insane. Do you know what weather's arriving, you know? And so it was perfect. It was utterly perfect, and I wouldn't change any of it. It was everything that I hoped it would be.
Can I just say I am very aware that my main contribution to most of these interviews, most of these portions of interviews, is either saying wow or kind of giggling. Yeah, sorry about that. He goes on to talk about that experience a lot more in the book, and he talked about it a lot at the talk as well. And some of the most profound experiences he had were with other people and the kindness of other people that he experienced along that journey. Okay, so the final part of this interview goes on to speak more about his venture called Embercombe. Now, this is a place down in Devon. It's in a valley in Devon. And it's somewhere that he created in order to bring these teachings to other people so you can go and do courses there or spend weekends there, just have time on the land. He'll talk about that a bit more in this section. But we began by, I just wanted to understand more what it was that led him in the first place to going to find these Native Americans and wanting to be mentored with them and committing himself to such a long process. You know, 20 years is a long time. So this next bit begins with him talking more about how he found himself ready for that experience.
For a very long time, since I was a child, I had this feeling I had not been born in the right time. I couldn't find anything interesting. We are talking, I was born in 1949, so it was a different world. But everything was so predictable. It was a horrendously predictable. You know, you go to a good school, you go to a university or something, and or you don't, in which case you go into factories or whatever. You just do put your head down, do work hard, do a good job, have a little house, all the usual things. And I found it so depressing. I just thought, oh my God, it's already been written. I just have to trudge along this path. And then I had a sense of the spirituality of nature, because I had deeply fallen in love with the smell of earth, of trees, of the different seasons, the moon cycles. And then suddenly it was all wrenched away from me, and it was like, that. Oh, that's childish, that's silly, and now you need to focus on your options, and estate agent or...
It's almost like a mini version of what happened back when the Romans came in, isn't
yes.
it? It's like we've got this playful spirit that
all this thing happens,
structure.
That's right.
And
So I asked myself a question. What do I really love? And I thought, that's just amazing feeling of a fire under a starry night. And being in a safe, warm, dry little shelter that you've made yourself, and the rain drumming down, but you're good, The snap of twigs that happens behind you in the darkness, and that you suddenly all your senses are totally alive and alert. The feeling that you could almost hear the reverberation of hundreds of feet stamping as some chant is worked up, this whole... I just thought, this is what I want. And at that time, nobody knew anything about the shamans of the South Americas, the kahunas of the South Seas, the Aboriginal. Nobody knew anything. The only information that came up at that time that was relevant, that felt connected, was that lame deer, rolling thunder, and black elk, these three Native American medicine men, had books written about them which were published in the late 60s, in the middle or late 70s. And I suddenly became aware these people still existed. And that was an immediate sense of recognition. I have to find these people and go and try and get them to teach me.
And you did?
And I did,
I want to talk a bit about the work you do at Embercombe. It's in a valley in Devon. Is it a distillation of all of the things that you've learned? Because you're very much about teaching others You know, it's about creating lots of people who can then go out
yes.
and lead in some way in, I guess, you know, with the children's fire, creating more people that have that belief and can go out and apply that in whichever part of the world they're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about Inukum.
Yes, you know, it has always existed with the purpose of seeking to inspire people. I think of it really like there are countless millions of wonderful people, but many of them, whether they're lost or whether they've forgotten or they need waking up or something. Because we have been lulled, we have been institutionalized into this sort of conforming with a story that is so clearly taking us towards a cliff edge. So the process of Embercombe really is to try and take the little glowing ember that each person is and blow on that ember until you get ignition and you get a flame. Then, of course, the whole work begins about putting sticks on that flame, otherwise it'll go out. But the purpose of Embercombe came to ignite within people, reawaken their love of everything that is now rapidly disappearing, and say, you know, you are invited, and you are important, and whatever you imagine or fantasize a bit about being your the lack of skills, experience, whatever it is, you know, all our little self-harming stories really are just, you know, are nothing in comparison to this invitation. And actually the truth is that if you made the choice to do something according to the thing that you particularly love and that you have a gift for, that is a magnificent and wonderful gift. People will benefit, the world will benefit, and you will feel good. So what's...
It's a win-win.
Yeah, it's just like, what's the matter with that? You know, you say you want to be happy, I can show you what, you know, all you need to do. There'll be challenges, but there's always challenges. Mm. So that's it. But, you know, we're proud of the fact that it, over time, flourished and good things happened. But we never really found our way to a sound economic model. And so this last September, we closed our doors and said we'll reopen them probably next May in 2019. And we will, meantime, have hopefully reorganized who we are in such a way to try and find a business model that can work. Because we're a charity, but we still have to deal with money.
Is this the biggest problem that we face?
Yeah, it is.
Isn't
massive.
It? Because otherwise, it seems to be a fight. It's very hard to make those two things, to make finding what you love and putting, I think as you say, I know you say about putting people and nature first before profit, which... It feels instinctively the right thing to do, and yet the society that we've created, it doesn't support that.
That's it.
And that's very difficult, and it often means that, you know, even wonderful organisations like Embercombe struggle.
Yeah.
Even though we're teaching people, we're not. You're teaching people how to find what they're passionate about.
Yeah.
How do we change that?
Yes, well, I don't know, truthfully, but I do feel that, assuming we have the time to do it, which is, I guess,
years.
Debatable,
yeah.
But I think change is happening. But it is an enormous challenge. How do you host an incubator, as it were, something different like this, whilst living inside the problem that, you know.
Mm. But is it a series of personal awakenings? I think maybe it is, actually. Mm. It feels like the only thing that can possibly work.
It feels like that to me, yes. Mm. So
for people that maybe can't get to Embercombe or are aware of these feelings within themselves, what do you think are important questions that they could... I think it can be for anyone, actually. What do you think are the most important questions that we need to ask ourselves that can maybe start us off on a path?
Well, I like these three questions. What is it you most deeply and profoundly love? You know, that's not a question to answer in a workshop you can start, but you know, it's not a one evening sitting down with a bit of paper. You know, it says deeply and profoundly love. I was never educated. My teachers never asked me that question. You know. When you inquire deeply with groups of people on that question, it's really quite shocking what often emerges. And the answer for many is, I never have. Mm. You know, the young woman that came to our place, very sick with 3 months to live, she was just saying, you know, I have a job. Deeply and profoundly loved? No, I just... I did what I studied the things that I thought I was good at, and I have a job. I don't deeply and profoundly love it. It pays the bills. My partner, deeply and profoundly love? Well, no, I wouldn't, you know, not really.
Right.
Yeah. It's fine, yeah. You know, but I'm not except the moment imagining a lifetime with this person, and so no, you know, my... Family, well, I would say I love them, but there's all kinds of unresolved things there, and I'm quite glad that I'm not living quite so close to them as I was before. Maybe there is someone there, I don't know. But anyway, she went through all these things. But a feeling is, when you know what you deeply and profoundly love, you have somehow defined sacred for you, yourself. And that's important, because you would never, that is what you stand by. You would become a protector of that. You ask what are your deepest and most profound gifts? It's the same story, really, for most people. I know what I'm educated in, I know what I'm experienced at, I've been told I'm good at this. Gifts is, I don't know, actually, after a lot of work, underneath my rather fragile self-confidence is a feeling that I'm not particularly good at anything much and don't have any... This is a terrifying thing, you know. Mm. If we were to do anything with our children and young people, it should be that they emerge feeling really good about who they are and what they have to offer. Mm. Because that allows someone... It's the first step to being peaceful, you know. When you feel you have nothing, no, and nobody gives a damn, and you are the bottom of the pile, who wouldn't be angry and mm-hmm. resentful and all those things? So
it's a real doing this work as an adult. Mm. It's a real stripping back, isn't it? You've got to undo a lot of layers to get right into
that's right
the core. And whereas if you're taught as a child. You're growing with that the whole time.
Yes,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
That's exactly. why it takes so long to
that's why it takes,
know the answer,
that's
I
right.
think. Yeah.
yeah. Mm. You've got to peel it all off. This is my opinion. You know, is it?
Mm.
Well, yes, it is. And then you trace it back and you find that's not that person's opinion. It's an opinion that was given to them. All kinds of ways in which these things are sort of embedded into us, which we think are... our values or something, you know, nothing of the kind. But anyway, so it's within those indigenous people, it was just assumption, a knowledge that when a baby is born, creation lodges a tiny little piece of her genius in that little being and whispers in their ear, you know, this is your gift, you know. Locate it, grow it, bring it to potential, share it. And when that happens, that should be where our work is located. That, because we will shine. We will be successful. we will feel needed. Everything good will happen. We'll feel joyful. Mm. We don't need our gifts to be the same. We need them to be different and varied and diverse. And so anyway, that's the second and third. One of my deepest and most profound responsibilities.
That's a biggie.
It's a biggie. Yeah. And of course, we're taught that your responsibilities, you know, to yourself, which of course is a good thing. You know, we are responsible, but ours is incredibly small. You know, if we're lucky, like my family, my children, my this that, but it's very clear in our culture when you walk down the street and you see people, you know, who are living in the street with no home, you know, no food, in all kinds of crisis, that we as a society do not believe that it is our responsibility to care for each other on that level. I have my family, but do I care for your family? You know, is the Yemen something that I need to consider? You know, what is the boundary of my leafy suburbs, leafy valleys of Devon? You know, it's all very nice. Do we care about what's happening in our cities? And anyway, those are questions, I think, worthy of some consideration.
Wondering. Mm. Yeah, pretty big questions.
Mm.
But the important ones.
Mm. There was a period of my life when I was in my middle teens when I really was profoundly depressed that I'd been born at this time. And most of that was simply around the fact that it seemed to be unutterably boring and predictable. And it took me quite a while to wake up to the fact that actually this is an extraordinary time. And it is a time when it's as if everything hangs in the balance. Some, of course, would say that we're already over the edge. Some would say we're not. Truthfully, I'd say most of us don't know. Every morning when I go to my cabin at Embercombe, there's a little robin who will meet me. I go into the cabin, I scoop out some bird food, I hold out my hand, and he comes and lands on my hand, and he eats that bird food. I look at that little robin, I listen to the bird song, I look at the valley, I think of the people that I love and have met, I think of the wondrous experience of having a life with some measure of privilege, as we all do, most of us here. And, you know, and it fills me with joy. So there is all manner of appalling, awful and challenging things happen, and there is limitless amount of beauty and wonder in around us as well. It would be a great shame if we allowed the fear and the ugliness of what has happened to take us under the wave, because then nothing can happen, if you see what I mean. I feel that it's really important for as many people as possible to just acknowledge the fact that it is just amazing privilege to have a life on this earth for a period of time, and that it can be filled with laughter and joyfulness and companionship along with tears and grief and bewilderment. But until you know, there are no more babies born, as it were, or until the last forest goes down, as it were, then we need to stand. To stand by the children's fire means that we will never, never give in until such time as we are brought down, if you see what I mean. And that is not that is an open-hearted thing. It's not about identifying enemies and attacking them, really. It's a deeply peaceful, loving movement that tries to bring things together, not polarize to different points of view that where we just carry on head-butting each other and, you know, not getting too far. It's an amazing time to be alive. I'm glad to be part of it for that reason.
There we go, Mac McCartney. If you like what he does and what he says, you can find a whole heap more of his stuff online. And if you just go to macmccartney.com, search it through Google or whatever, and a bunch of his videos comes up and his website. I'm so aware. So I'm recording this. It's the 25th of November when I'm recording this show. And outside of this window, there is some sort of Christmas market going on. Somebody's dressed as Santa singing Christmas songs. See a bored elf vaping and sort of just people aimlessly wandering around, and I don't know, man, I'm not sure this consumerism thing really works. So maybe if you feel the same way and those words of Mac spoke to you, then it'll lead you to inquire more and perhaps ponder those three questions that he set at the end there. You're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. I am Charlotte Petz, and this is Growing Wild. Our last interview is Ruth Allen, and we spoke to her a couple of shows back, and she did that wonderful trip to Bosnia. She gives us a little recap of the adventure. She's someone who I think kind of embodies some of what Max talked about, somebody who has found stuff that she's passionate in and follows those dreams and those calls to adventure. So this is Ruth giving us a recap and telling us how that expedition went.
So I ran about 350 kilometres, and I did a traverse of the Dinaric Alps through Bosnia. So I went from the coast, the border with Croatia to the border of Montenegro, and went through the mountains. And I was essentially fast packing, so I had everything I needed for the trip on me that I carried, camping along the way, and, you know, eating out in the wild, all of that stuff. So yeah,
did you have everything you needed? Was there anything that you took that you didn't, you're like, oh, I can't believe I brought this and I've just had to carry it that far?
I think the only thing, I think I did actually a really sublime job. I was pretty proud of how I managed to sort of nail the gear aspect, as it were. The only thing I didn't need was the one of those kind of sports towels that I'd cut in half. So I thought, well, yeah, I haven't got the space for the full size towel, so I cut it in half. But actually,
they're,
I could have just done
anyway,
without that
they?
Half. I know. But in the end, if I just, you know, used my, you know, a jumper or something and then kind of rinse that out, it would have been fine.
Okay.
So that was the only thing
that is not bad going.
It's not bad going. Yeah. The kit I took really, really served me well, and I came back feeling very fondly for it. So I kind of washed the tops that I ran in and then continued to wear them for like the weeks after, just because I was really emotionally attached to them.
How nervous were you, or how were you apprehensive when you arrived, or sort of when you got on the plane, did that dissipate quite quickly? You know, how did those feelings kind of manifest and progress throughout the trip?
I'm never really okay on a flight, because I'm pretty terrified of flying, although I've done a lot of work and it's getting better. So it's usually when I touch down anywhere that I'm overcome with such a profound sense of relief having survived the flight, that I start every adventure in quite an excited mindset that, like, I'm alive, let's do this. So I got to Sarajevo, and it was really exciting. And I think something for me kicks in those moments, because I don't feel the anxiety at that point. And I think that remained true really until I was running in the first couple of days, and I realized water's going to be a problem for me here. And then I think it would be fair to say that I had a persistent water anxiety throughout the duration of the run. You know, where am I going to get the water? Am I going to have enough water? Am I going to go thirsty? You know, those thoughts were constantly in my head. And I think they crowded out a lot of the potential other anxieties about, you know, other worries and other fears, if you like.
Well, that's quite a massive one to feel. Was that a problem? What happened about the water?
So I guess the water issue came about because there had been very it'd been a dry summer in Bosnia, and it's a karstic limestone environment, which means the water just sort of, well, as you probably know, it just goes straight into the ground. And if there's been good water and the water table's high, I guess you get the springs, but there were no springs. So every spring was dry. So I realized quite quickly, I'm going to have to carry all of my water, which added, you know, I wasn't confident unless I had at least 3 liters of water on me. So, because it's very, very hot for the first week. So I had to carry a lot of water, and that upped my weight quite a lot. So so that was a problem, but it was also quite humbling, really, because it's not often you have to genuinely worry about water, is it? We have it very easy. That was a lesson, really, in not taking those things for granted. I had suspected before I went that it was going to be a problem, but actually it was.
Did you dream about just drinking lots of water? Was that one thing you did when you finished? Did you drink an incredible amount of liquid?
Yeah. I just sat with my mouth under a tap for a week.
What sort of people did you encounter along the way? Did you have many interactions with people, or was it more or less solitary than you thought it might be?
I think that's, yeah. The people aspect was a really interesting one and really divided. So I wouldn't see anyone in the mountains. I didn't see anyone really in the mountains. There were a couple of guys on one particular stage who were staying up in a hut, and they had like a key, and they were very welcoming. They said, come in, and they made me a drink and gave me some food. All the rest of the time there was no one in the mountains. So the only time I really saw people was when I went through villages and towns, and obviously it's Sarajevo at the beginning and the end. And I absolutely loved the people I met, and I really wanted to take time to try and learn a bit about the Bosnian culture, because obviously it's not an area that people are really going to that much, certainly from the UK, and was really keenly aware at all times of the Bosnian war and wanting to know a bit more about that. And I think it's that people element, actually, even though I was incredibly isolated during the run itself and in the mountains, that kind of left me with a sense of how adventure can be really a sort of a caring space and a learning space about people. It's not just about environment or mountain cultures, but just something, the peripheral kind of contact with people, I think was really interesting. It left me with quite a lot. I really came away thinking, yes, you know, Bosnia, I really love Bosnia. I really love the Bosnian people. And that was a great takeaway I wasn't necessarily expecting, I suppose.
It seems a bit too clangy, but I mean, people do want to know what the kind of the hardest bits and the best bits were. I mean, can it be polarized into such experience, or was it a sort of a constant moving through each day? Did you find that, you know, every day you had a high and a low and a...
Yeah, I mean, I think I had those highs and lows moment by moment, you know, within the space of 10 minutes. I would be really, really... I had these huge mood swings, really, kind of extremes of my mood were really present sort of every day. So I would have these euphoric moments where I would look around and be like, wow, this is really wild. I'm really isolated. I'm miles from anywhere. And this is amazing. And the sun's shining and I've got enough water. And then I would get lost again because the route finding was really hard and it was very rough terrain for a lot of it. And I would just plummet to the depths of kind of despair. I was very fragile at times. And I think that really took me by surprise. I think I've been quite... I don't want to be too hard on myself and say arrogant about it, but I kind of have this thing where I talk a lot about solo adventure and solitude and how, you know, I choose to do that when, you know, I could go away with someone else, but I sort of choose that solitude and aloneness. And actually, it kind of upped my own ante in that way. And so there was a real tension between sometimes I was loving that solitude and sometimes it was just breaking me. And for the most inane reasons, you know, I would get vaguely lost for 10 minutes and I would be back into that. I can't do this. Yeah. I'm useless. I'm hopeless. So I think I don't really understand why I was on that kind of knife edge so much, because it's not like I haven't pushed myself before, but there was something about it which I haven't quite nailed yet that kept just pushing me over the edge and kept me quite uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that was the main thing.
Yeah, did that feel a bit frightening sometimes to be going to such extremes within such a short amount of time, or do you have a confidence in knowing that you just have to ride those out and it'll change again and it'll change again? And
I think, yeah, I think both of those. I think it was frightening, and there were times when I was worried about myself, like, you know, why am I finding this so hard today? Why am I finding it so hard this hour? Or what is that about? You know, I work in this kind of domain, if you like, in that kind of psychology, I suppose. And so I thought I probably knew myself better. So I was quite surprised by that. But at the same time, I was curious about it, I suppose, more than afraid, if I reflect on that. It was, you know, why is this happening? But fundamentally being confident that I would be okay. So I wasn't, you know, lying in my tent at night in the middle of nowhere fearing for my life. I was just a bit like,
just a bit thirsty,
confused by myself, but confident, as you say, that it would be okay, that it would pass and the next day would come and I'd go through it again and there would be the euphoria again. So it was a bit of an interesting process for me, actually. Quite, I said humbling at the beginning of our conversation, but it was really, it's easy to be trite, I suppose, and say, oh, it's very humbling, but it was, because it taught me new things about myself that I had taken for granted would be okay, I suppose.
So it's grown you.
Yeah, I think it has. Yeah. It's grown me up a bit more, and I think maybe that has that echo in the sense that, you know, my inner critic is busy now with that. I've kind of placated it for a while. It's grown me, and I kind of feel okay with what it's done. So,
Can you ask for much more from an adventure, other than just feeling grown by it?
Yeah, I don't think you can, really, can you? I mean, what more can you ask?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have had kind of regular water, but but I wouldn't have been grown if
too easy.
That had been the case. But yeah, I think sometimes it's, you know, you have to make that choice to take something from, you know, you have to look, I suppose, to some degree for the lessons as well. And it's easy just to go, oh, well, that could have been better, or I was a bit, you know, I didn't have as much mental fortitude as I would have liked, and I could have chosen to go the other way and just beat myself up for that. But in the end, you know, I guess you choose to grow sometimes. From the beginning, there was this question of what's the big deal? And I kind of went into it thinking, well, who's going to care? People are doing bigger things than this, faster things, longer things. And the whole journey for me, that kind of the run was a process of, well, it's a big deal for me. It doesn't have to be a big deal for everyone. It doesn't have to be the biggest and the best of anything. It's, you know, I've got something from this, and I've learned something about my own spirit of adventure and what adventure means to me. And yeah, as you said, you can't ask more than that. But I remember just getting on, trying to get back where I started, back to Sarajevo, and just sat on the bus and thinking, nothing has changed and everything has changed, you know, and nobody knows and it's just me. And so that was, yeah, it was a kind of an anticlimax, but it was, you know, I kind of had some sweet moments by myself, just looking out the window and thinking, yeah, I've done it, I'm all right.
Yeah, she's pretty all right. I love that little bit at the end there where everything has changed and nothing has changed. Wonderful. Okay, so we've come to the end of the show. A lot less music than usual. I hope that's okay. I just wanted to get in more of these fascinating people. You can find out more about Ruth on her website, which is whitepeakwellbeing.com. You can find out more about Mac on macmccartney.com and buy his book, The Children's Fire. It's wonderful. It will enhance your life. And maybe ponder those three questions that he put as well. And just as a little recap, it was, what do you deeply and profoundly love? What are your gifts and what are your responsibilities? Maybe if we all sat down and gave those some time, we'd benefit from that, I reckon. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can. I am on Instagram and Twitter at growingwildfm. You can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com, or you can contact the show via the show page on Radio Reverb. www.growingwildinthe.com and search for Growing Wild in the show page. I'm going to play you out with What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening. Go well.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.